or against their volition. That he wasn't the one who killed those girls. Lucian fidgeted for a moment, unsure as to where to go with this information. He huffed a breath from his mouth in frustration.
You talk to him alone?
There was an incident in the cafeteria, and Schaefer went to help take care of that. Lucian pushed his hat back on his head, a little confounded.
So, the brother says he's innocent?
That's what he said. Lucian thought about it.
They all say that.
He says he killed the guard in Rawlins, but that it was self-defense. He nodded, and then took a step out into the hallway to make sure no one was listening before coming back in and closing the door.
Anything else?
John Schaefer was pushing hard to get rid of me. Offered me a car.
Well, you were pretty hip on leaving.
I turned around and looked at him. Lucian, if somebody is trying to put together a syndicate of sheriffs that go around solving each other's problems by murdering suspects, we're looking for a killer.
Every one of these sheriffs has killed men, so that ain't exactly going to thin the herd.
Maybe not, but it's a start.
Just talk.
Dangerous talk. He looked shaken, but not completely convinced. Lucian, we've got one man dead, and another one missing, and a man in prison who says he's innocent. Now, I'm not sure these two series of crimes are connected, but I'm not ruling anything out. If you've got another scenario, I'll be glad to entertain it. His eyes sharpened, and those dark brows furrowed over the walnut eyes.
So, what do you want to do?
A full-blown investigation will have to wait until we get off this train, but in the meantime, we could take a look in his compartment.
Schaefer's?
Yep.
For what?
I don't know. I sighed and leaned an elbow on the bunk again. You need to go find him and keep him busy for a while. And in the meantime, if you could ask Mr. Gibbs to come here, I'll get him to open Schaefer's compartment and I'll take a look around. I'm not sure how this all fits together, but there's something we're missing.
All righty.
He started to go, but then turned back.
Be careful. If what you're saying is true, there's more than one of them in on this. And if it is Schaefer, he's bound to know you've got suspicions.
He moved to go again, but then stopped and added,
Welcome back.
I'm not sure I'm all the way back.
Well, you let me know when you get there, and I'll think about cutting you a check.
He turned and walked away. When he was gone, I pulled my M1911A1 from my duffel, dropped the magazine to check the loads, and then slapped it back between the grips. It was the one I'd carried in Vietnam, on Johnson Atoll, and in Alaska. When I started, Lucian had offered me a standard barrel length 38 from the department locker, but I'd grown used to the weight of the large frame semi-automatic, and had felt naked in its absence. It had been a calculated risk bringing the Colt home with me from Southeast Asia. Servicemen were not allowed to keep their weapons, but the sidearm had become a part of me. I weighed it in my hand, and couldn't help but think about what Henry had said about it getting heavier, and how I wasn't so sure I was gripping the thing as much as it was holding on to me. There was a movement in the doorway, and I turned, carefully slipping the Colt behind my back. I heard you and Sheriff Connolly just now. I waited for her to continue. Look, I don't mean to threaten you. She glanced up and down the hall behind her, just as Lucian had. But if you don't help me, I'm going to tell everyone what you're up to.
Well, for someone who doesn't want to threaten me, that was pretty good.
I need your help. The clerk sidled in and closed the door behind her.
Given our most recent interaction, I'd just as soon you left that open.
I haven't been completely honest with you. She leaned against the door. Look, I know we didn't get off to a good start. She stood there for a moment and then lowered her voice. I have a reason to be on this train, too. She whispered. My sister was one of the girls who were killed.
My eyes met hers from under the brim of my hat, and I lowered my voice, too.
Go on.
She studied me, weighing how much she could trust me.
My little sister, Melanie, was strangled to death, and these sons of bitches haven't done anything to bring the bastard that did it to justice. She closed her fingers into fists. Her name was Melanie Wheeler, and she's dead because of those men.
That's your real name? Wheeler?
Yes.
I nodded. Why were you with George McKay?
I couldn't get close to Schaefer, and I thought McKay could help me.
Help you what?
Find the man who killed my sister.
Ed Schaefer appears to be at the top of that list.
You spoke with him, and you know he didn't do it.
I sighed.
And what about McKay? She gestured in futility. He took a powder.
I broke a smile, just wide enough to let her know I wasn't buying it.
You honestly don't know what happened to him?
No.
How much did he know about you?
I told him about my sister, and he said he'd help.
With privileges?
Her jaw stiffened.
Not all of us are as big as a refrigerator with a head. We have to find other ways of getting what we need.
I stared at her, but said nothing, and she made a move to leave.
Sorry to have bothered you, deputy. I guess I misjudged.
I threw out a hand and held the door shut as she looked up at me, tears in her eyes.
Schaefer's brother was tried and convicted, but I know he wasn't the one who killed my little sister.
How do you know? Her glance dropped to my side, where the big Colt hung in my hand, and I watched as her eyes widened. I slipped my sidearm into the back of my waistband and kept a hand on the door.
How do you know that?
She wiped the tears away with the back of her hand and then adjusted the extravagant pile of blonde hair on top of her head, confirming my suspicion that it was a wig.
Because I saw Melanie after her date with Ed.
I stood with Pamela Delahunt as she made the final preparations for the 25-hour drive. I glanced back at the horse trailer in the flat light of the afternoon, the horizontal beams striking the raised surface of the rigid metal and the edges of furniture that stuck out the openings. I wonder if anybody's ever hauled a horse in one of those things. She laughed at the old Wyoming joke. You're not going to do it all at once, I hope.
No, I'll take a couple of breaks along the way.
I nodded. I'm sorry I caused this trouble for you.
Oh, I may have caused some of it myself.
She nodded, biting her lip and placing a foot onto the running board.
Was he a good guy?
I leaned against the side of her truck and studied her. Your grandfather?
Yeah.
I glanced back at Vic and Henry, leaning on the fender of the rental car parked just behind Pamela's trailer. Yep, he was one of the best.
My mother hardly ever talked about him.
Sometimes that's the way people deal with the pain of losing a loved one.
I could feel her wanting to get on the road.
Well, we're holding you up.
Her head dropped, but she leaned in closer.
I never got to meet him, you know. I was born in 83.
She took a breath. He died in 1972.
Yep.
So this man, he killed my grandfather?
Yes.
You're sure of it?
Yes, but that's not your problem.
I leaned in a little closer myself.
He would have wanted you to get in this truck and get on with your life.
Helping her along, I opened the door and held it for her.
So, come on. Let's get you on the road.
Reluctantly, she climbed in and I closed it behind her. She laid an arm on the sill and studied the road ahead.
Thank you.
I laughed.
For what?
For caring.
She pulled the truck in gear with a flourish and backed the trailer directly into our rented Mitsubishi. Vic and Henry leaped out of the way just before the trailer smashed the grill, hood, and one of the headlights with a thundering crunch. After that, the only sound was a slight tinkling as shards of broken glass dropped on the pavement. Pamela was alarmed as she turned and looked at me, then glanced in the side mirror at the destruction behind us.
Oh, my God!
I believe Florida is in the other direction.
She burst out crying, and I reached in and gripped her shoulder, doing everything I could to keep from laughing until Henry and Vic joined me at the window. Vic, of course, was the first to speak.
"Fuck it, it's a rental!"
Still sniffling, Pamela wiped her nose at the back of her hand as I pulled a handkerchief from my inside pocket and handed it to her. "Here, you can mail it back to me." Nodding, she pulled the gear lever into first and inched out and away. Vic and Henry joined me in the street, Vic following the horse trailer for a few steps, then turning to look at me, her arms crossed.
"You don't think she's involved?"
"Nope." She glanced over her shoulder as the truck and trailer made a turn, heading for the highway.
"I hope you're right."
I breathed a laugh. This just keeps getting better and better.
The thing is, I was supposed to go out on a blind date with John that night, but I just had a funny feeling and begged off.
She started crying again and looked at me with tears on her cheeks.
"And the next morning they found her in the park, near the railroad tracks in Laramie."
"That doesn't necessarily mean that John did it."
"Well, if he didn't, then who else?"
She stared at me.
"What did he tell you?"
"Who, Ed?"
"Yes."
It was a somewhat limited conversation through a steel door.
I gestured toward the hallway where she'd obviously been listening. "You heard the conversation between Lucian and me, so you know as much as we do."
"Do I?"
I pushed my hat back on my head and studied her.
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Did he say something about my sister?"
"No."
"You sure?"
"He didn't mention any of the women by name."
She seemed disappointed, and I was sure it was hard to believe that someone you loved could have something like that done to them and then simply be forgotten like yesterday's news.
"I'm sorry." There was a knock and she jumped. Mr. Gibbs opened the door and stuck his head inside and then immediately retreated.
"Sorry, Mr. Longmire, I didn't know Miss Leclerc was in there with you."
I called out to him. "It's okay, you can open the door, Mr. Gibbs."
"Yes, sir."
He did and widened his eyes at me in a conspiratorial fashion.
Sheriff Connolly asked me to assist you?"
I glanced at Kim. "You'll excuse me?" She looked at Gibbs and then at me.
"Sure, I guess."
I joined Gibbs in the hallway and followed him toward the front of the train. In the space between cars, I placed a hand on his shoulder and asked in a low voice,
"I'm assuming that Sheriff Connolly has told you what's going on?"
He didn't look at me.
"I don't want to know, Mr. Longmire. I have enough trouble remembering which doors I locked and which ones I unlocked."
He stepped into the next car, turned to the door of the first cabin on the left, and knocked.
"Sheriff Schaefer?"
"I think Lucian is keeping him busy somewhere else."
He ignored me and knocked again, before slipping a hand down to pull out a prodigious key ring. He unlocked the door, then quietly continued past me down the hallway until he disappeared. As the train rumbled on, the door threatened to shut, so I stuck a hand out and held it, slowly pushing it open. The room was neat and orderly, with a medium-sized valise sitting on the lower bunk along with a long coat and a pistol case. After a quick run through the cabinets and closet, I picked up the case, ascertaining that it was empty. I slid the coat aside and looked at the valise, noticing that the latch was locked. I crouched there with my thumb on the metallic wheels. Now came the tricky part. Birth dates were common, but Schaefer didn't strike me as the type. There were a few dates he'd mentioned back at the hospital, but it was the cataclysmic fire that stuck in my head. Maybe it had stuck in his, too. I thumbed the numbers 9, 11, and 17, and watched as the latches popped free. On the top was a small container of mustache wax. Shaking my head, I pulled a sweater from the suitcase and pushed some other items of clothing aside. It was beginning to dawn on me just how stupid this might be when I noticed some newspaper clippings in the lid pocket and pulled a few out. Holding one up, I began reading. Following a tip, a half-dozen Rawlins police officers surrounded the rear of the Pioneer Cafe on November 6 at 1 p.m., where they found the deceased,
The exact circumstance of the death is yet to be determined, but it appears the young woman was strangled. I leafed through the clippings and read another one. Pauline Davenport was discovered by Wydot November 8th in a barrow ditch adjacent to the parking lot on the south side of Green River, her neck having been broken. And another. The victim, Lisa Pell, had been strangled and left in an abandoned vehicle. Another, Francine Harrison. Yet another, Elaine Lentz. And even another. The Laramie native and University of Wyoming student was found strangled Saturday night near Optimist Park after her brother said that she hadn't returned from a date the previous evening. I glanced at the name. Melanie Wheeler. Wheeler was enrolled at the School for Geology and was scheduled to graduate in the spring, and as near as police can tell, she was killed on the day before. I glanced at the date at the top of the clipping, 1965, November 4th. It was November 3rd today. I thought about it, the same day Melanie Wheeler was killed, 7 years ago. It really wasn't a great deal more other than a few quotes from the family and neighbors on what a fine young woman she'd been. There were a half dozen in all, young women who had been strangled in locations trailing across the I-80 corridor from Cheyenne all the way to Evanston in a 6-year period. I checked the rest and noticed that the dates the bodies were found were all in early to mid-November. I carefully folded the clippings, replacing them in the lid of the case before closing it and latching it shut. I placed the coat and the pistol case back as they'd been and then glanced around the room to check my work before exiting. I closed the door behind me just as two men turned the corner, the knob still in my hand. I smiled at Sheriffs Tillman and Brown. "Can't seem to get my key to work." Tillman, the Sheridan County man, was the first to speak. "Probably not, seeing as how that's not your room." Remembering that the different cars were named for Wyoming mountain ranges, I glanced around. "Isn't this Bighorn?" Brown shook his head. "Wind River." "Oh, no wonder." Pretending to palm my key back in my pocket, I looked at the two of them as Brown leaned against the wood-paneled wall. "We heard you were calling it quits." I nodded. "Changed my mind, I guess." Tillman's eyes narrowed. "What did that? Visiting with John Schaefer's crazy brother?" I held the smile. "Maybe so. Ed tell you that he's innocent?" Pulling my hand from my pocket, I shifted, just to give me a clear grab on my sidearm if I needed it. "He might have mentioned something about that." The man with the thin face nodded and studied me. "Just don't want you getting the idea that you're the only one he's dumped that load of horseshit on." I studied him back. "What makes you so sure that it's horseshit?" Timmons glanced toward Brown with a knowing look, and then turned back to me. "Girls were dying, 6 of them to be exact, and that all stopped when they locked that crazy son of a bitch up a year ago." He leaned in to me. "Look, you need to figure out which team you're playing on, and get suited up. You got me?" I didn't say anything, mostly because I knew if I spoke again and I didn't like his response, chances were I'd use his buddy to club him into unconsciousness and then throw the two of them off the train. Not necessarily needing to go in that direction, I started past them. "Excuse me." Brown gave room, but Tillman left a shoulder square in the passageway. I said, "Excuse me." He looked up at me and then smirked before stepping aside, cocking his head as he watched me pass. I made the corner and then realized I was at the front of the train and there really wasn't anywhere to go. I thought about turning back but didn't want to give the two sheriffs the satisfaction, so I just stood there thinking about what I knew, what I didn't, and, more important, who it was I trusted. It was possible that Schaefer was innocent and just kept the clippings from his brother's murders as a penance, but I had to be sure that there were no connections between the two cases. Marv Leland was dead, and George McKay was missing, and possibly dead too, unless McKay was the guilty party, in which case all I was doing was chasing my tail. Why would McKay kill Leland? There wasn't any rational motivation, unless he was involved in the sheriff's cabal, and who knew if there was anything to that? In the short amount of time I'd spent with McKay, he'd struck me as a party-line guy, unlikely to break ranks, So why would anyone kill him? It was even harder to come up with a motivation for murdering Marv Leland. Everyone loved the man. But maybe he was coming too close to breaking up the cabal, as he had called it. In a matter of hours, we'd be stopping to pick up his body, and if I could talk the majority of the sheriffs into it, maybe they would allow me to examine it to see if I could glean any clues. Looking up through the glass in the forward end of the accordion-like passageway, I could see that the next car was the tender for the engine. And I had to smile at the thought that Tillman and Brown had watched me attempt to leave this way. Then another thought crossed my mind as I felt the cold through the grimy window's thick glass. If there was nothing except the tender and the engine ahead, why had the two of them come from that direction?
Chapter 14.
I called the commandant, and we've got highway patrolmen in Nebraska, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida watching out for Mrs. Delahunt. If we were guarding her any closer, she'd have a police escort. I leaned on the counter of the rental car company. Thanks, Jim. He hung up, and I handed the receiver back to the nice, clean-cut young man. He hung it up and looked at me. I don't think I can rent you another car until I talk with my supervisor. I shifted my weight. And where's your supervisor?
Lunch.
Then can somebody give us a ride over to the windshield repair place on Old Lincoln Highway?
That's against company policy. Besides, I'm the only one here.
So that's a no. He smiled and nodded, and I gave up and joined Vic, Henry, and Dog in the lot. The man who had towed the Mitsubishi wiped his hands off on a red cotton rag that he'd pulled from his back pocket and handed me a clipboard.
I don't suppose you'd like to give us a ride over to Old Lincoln Highway?
He shrugged.
It's against company policy.
Right. I turned to the bear. You want to call us a cab?
I already did.
He gestured toward the red four-door Jeep pulling up beside us, which missed my foot by inches. She stopped and rolled the window down.
What did you do?
I glanced at the Terror, the Cheyenne Nation, and then back to the greatest legal mind of our time.
What makes you think it was us?
Dog, knowing a good deal when he saw one, jumped up in her window, and she massaged his ears.
It's always you, Dad.
She had a point. She always did. It was something she got from her mother, along with an unerring bullshit meter. We circled around. Dog climbed into the space behind the rear seats, and Vic and I climbed into the back, which meant Henry got the front, along with the third degree.
The bear will explain.
It is a long story.
Well, I've got to get back to work, so just tell me what I need to know. Tossing today's Tribune Eagle in Henry's lap, she wheeled out of the parking lot. But before you get started, you'd better take a look at this. The Cheyenne Nation unfolded the paper and grunted.
I sat up straighter. What now?
He glanced back at me.
It would appear that we are not alone in our responsibility for Pamela Leland Delahunt's difficulties. She apparently wrote a letter, an open letter, to the court, the world at large, and, more important, Governor and Carol Fisk, in favor of keeping the prisoner incarcerated no matter what his physical condition.
Let me see.
It is a very convincing letter.
He held it away and began reading aloud.
I never met my grandfather, but there is a piece of music that reminds me of the loss of him every day.
I slid a hand across the sooty condensate on the surface of the window and looked out of the spot I had cleared before it could ice up again. The only way I saw to go forward was a ladder on the left that led up and over the tender car toward the locomotive. At least, that's where I hoped it led. Cranking my hat down, I flipped up the collar on my jacket and pulled on my gloves, even going so far as to take the gold buckaroo scarf that my mother had given to me from an inside pocket. I tied it around the lower part of my face, looking for all the world like a train robber. It was well below freezing outside, and with the train moving, it was going to feel a lot colder than that. Once I was prepared, I pushed the door open and stepped onto the grating that divided the two cars, but there was nothing I could see that was of interest. Reaching out to grasp the ladder's rail, I hoisted myself up and climbed until the hurricane rush of air struck me at the top, and I started seriously wondering what the heck I was doing. Starting over the top, I was glad to see that the handrails continued the whole way, even if there appeared to be a large box in the middle that I was going to have to scramble over. Crawling on my hands and knees, I held my head down in an attempt to prevent both my hat and myself from disappearing over the side as the high plains rushed by. The topography wouldn't change much until we got to the bluffs of the Green River near Rock Springs. Here, the partially snow-covered landscape looked like the beginnings of the Arctic Circle. By the time I got to the engine, I was covered in a fine sheet of ice that crackled and fell off as I dropped my legs over the side of the tender and climbed down.